All right, everyone, welcome to another episode of The Big Questions with Big John. I am your host, Big John, and today I have a special guest. Goes back, forget politics for now, forget libertarianism for now. We're going old school. I'm going back to my roots in the fantasy sports journalism category, I guess. And to that extent, I'm very happy to have an OG like myself. Those of us that, you know, we have gray hair or no hair, whatever the case may be, but we go back a while. My guest today is a pioneering figure in the fantasy football world with a career spanning over three decades. He began playing fantasy football in 1986 and turned his passion into a profession in 1993, establishing himself as one of the original fantasy football diehards. As a renowned expert, he has provided invaluable insights through his work at footballdiehards.com and now at footballguys.com. His expertise has earned him numerous accolades, including induction into the Fantasy Sports Writers Association Hall of Fame. Known for his engaging writing style and deep understanding of the game, Bob continues to be a trusted voice in the fantasy football community, offering strategic advice and analysis to enthusiasts worldwide. Everyone, please welcome Mr. Bob Harris. Bob, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic. I think I'm going to come back every day for that intro. It was well-crafted and super complimentary. I appreciate that.
No problem. If anyone deserves it, it's certainly you. So let's start out, Bob, a little bit by giving folks – I want to give them a little bit of understanding and context as how you came to get into fantasy sports journalism, because
sure.
I think when we started and certainly around that era, there was no such thing as fantasy sports journalism. As a matter of fact, I think we were pretty much ridiculed and shunned by the, quote, traditional sports writers. Those of us that go back, we can remember famously someone like Peter King saying he'd never do fantasy football, and, you know, or Don Banks famously getting into arguments with all of us. Right. So how did you get into it? How did you get your start?
You know, to your point, we were kind of the toy department of the toy department. Right. The sports section was like considered in the newsroom the toy department. We were a small subset of that with even less respect. So a friend of mine traveled to San Diego. I lived in Tucson, Arizona. It's a group of friends, you know, we pal around all the time, huge football fans. We all played football, enjoyed watching football together. So one of us went to San Diego on a job and came back about a year later in 1986 and said, "Hey, you guys, I found a thing. You're going to love it." And love it we did. It was fantastic. It was fantasy football, of course. And, you know, just like unbelievable that we had not thought of this ourselves and unbelievable that we had not been playing it all along. Also, about a week into playing it, I was thinking, we don't have the information to play this right. Like, we don't know enough, right? Like, right, you know, things would happen. You get your USA Today in the middle of the week, the Wednesday injury report. By Sunday, a guy who is probable on Wednesday is not playing, and you're going, what the hell happened? So, you know, that kind of put the germ in my mind. I was a bit of a graphic designer at the time. I started creating a newsletter for my league with copious smack talk and all nature of ribbing and fun and information, too. And it kind of, you know, the idea just germinated. And it just like, it struck me at some point, if everyone loves this as much as me, there's a fortune to be made here. I'm sure you had similar thoughts back in the day.
So
I jumped in with both feet. You know, it was an interesting journey, kind of went in and like with the printed route, I did some things differently than some of the other people early on. There weren't very, very many of us doing it. But I started, I included a mailing that went out, like an 8-page mail. There was a battle to get out every Wednesday because I was fancy, man. Did all the typesetting and, you know, printed it out and actually took it to a printer, the negatives to a printer and the whole nine yards. But we did that, and then we'd do a fax one day a week. So the user could pick their choice of days, Thursday, Friday, or Saturday, to get a single page fax that covered all 32 teams. And I had a friend in New York City working for the WFAN radio station. His name's Steve Cohen. You've probably heard of him since if you're in this business. He went on to become the vice president in charge of NFL radio for Sirius. But at the time, he was just a WFAN producer. And he would call me every day, "Harris, I got the news." We'd run it down, and I'd go through it. He'd also wrote a column for me every week, And much to, you know, he was always a driving force, always had his eye on the price. Paris, when are we getting paid for this? You know, and so, so that was all. And so he went on the ESPN. There was a point, I think, where ESPN reached out to me and said, man, we'd like you to come do this. I said, no, I'm going to be bigger than ESPN, sir. Here, you could have my friend Steve. We see how it works out for both of us. Decisions matter. But there came a point, I'd want to say in 94, I started, you know, the first year sending out the fax was miserable. I had a single phone line. People would call and wonder where their fax is. And, well, you just blew up the lie, and that's where your fax is. And I would sit there in a puddle of tears and sweat trying to get these things out. Next year, fax broadcasting came around. And also the next year, a thing called the Internet came around. One of my subscribers called and said, hey, you ever hear of the World Wide Web? I said, no, tell me more. He said, well, you could probably send out all the stuff you're sending out now, except you wouldn't have to pay for it. You could do a million of them. That just sounds like a good idea.
And you know what's funny? It's like listening to you go, it's really interesting to me because you threw out a lot of stuff in there and it was bringing up memories, right? So, like, I got my start by writing a stupid newsletter for our Stratomatic League.
Right.
You know, and, like, pretending that it was real, right? Like, so-and-so this week decided to call a blitz on third and long and – cost them the game or whatever, you know, and it was just
smack talk.
Smack talk, college smack talk amongst friends. And it's funny, I think, sometimes how we entered it, right? Like, so I entered it a different way, which was I entered it from the tech side. So early on, you know, I was working on Wall Street and I said, hey, I work with numbers all day. I work in projections and forecasts. How does this work for football? You know, and the first webpage I put up, you know, my boss, when I was on Wall Street, said, hey, there's this thing called the Internet, and there's this thing called Mosaic, I think he said, something called the browser. I'm not quite sure. He goes, see how we can make money off of this. Literally, that was my directive as a 25-year-old or 26-year-old on Wall Street. And I said, sure, I'll learn. And I taught myself HTML, and I was publishing a once-a-week, quote, newsletter on the Internet, right? And I think the first question I ever had was, if you're an NFL GM, who would be the first player you draft and why? And to my astonishment, I got like 1,000 responses to that. And I said, wow, that's off of nothing. So I had the same sort of epiphany you did, if we need all this information. And another figure that a lot of people, casual fans or even somewhat veterans, Steve Cohen, I think a lot of people don't realize how he – affected the careers of so many people. Like when I got my SiriusXM gig, it was Steve Cohen. I just, you know, I sent him an email and I said, hey, Steve, remember me? And he said, sure, you want a show?
The story of how I got on the radio with Steve was my, started a show with Maurice Jones-Drew.
There you go.
Like for Jacksonville. He started listening to shows in Jacksonville where Mike Dempsey was a local radio guy who did once a week a fantasy show with a guy named Bob Harris on it. I get the call from Cohen, Harris, I hear you on this show. You know, and so Dempsey started doing a show with MJD, running with MJD. And then I think a year or 2 years later, Dempsey and I had our own show. And I've been on for the, I think this last year was the 14th year.
Oh, wow.
I've been on and ready to jump in again on my 15th. So. It's been going reasonably well. Cohen has moved on to bigger and better things, but a big role. And it's funny how you meet people.
Yeah.
I lived in Tucson. He went to the University of Arizona, had mutual friends, and just, you know, kind of got palling around a little bit. And when it came time to start doing something, you know, said, oh, man, Cohen kind of does this. Let's talk to him. It's just funny how the world works around. And, you know, you mentioned the Internet part of it. I mean, I think the big leap for me was getting on the Internet, being a bit of a graphic designer.
Right.
I became super adept at web design. In fact, really good, award-winning, and came up with a lot of interesting innovations that other people weren't doing, kind of set myself apart because, you know, it just struck me like, nobody knows. I won like a top 5% of the award or something from a newspaper. The guy calls me and he say, man, I'm looking at this website. You must have like 50 guys working for you. And I'm sitting there in my underpants in that puddle of sweat going, why should I tell him? Yes, 50 people in there, you know. And it struck me like that's what people are going to think. I can be whatever I present to the world. And that became a big factor in what I was doing and how I went on, like, you know, as we became an industry, I want to say, trying to help other people look like more than they were, because if we all look good, then that whole toy department of the toy department thing might at some point go away. So I designed a lot of sites for a lot of the companies out there, pretty much all the early companies. I was at least creating graphics for them, if not the websites, and getting heavily into the technology and working with guys like David Dodds, who went on Football Guys. And he and I would spend hours on the phone, like trying to hack stuff, figure out how people were using the Java, all these weird things that are totally outdated now. We were trying to sort our way through. He was making like trade calculators. I was making pages and trying to embed real audio, all kinds of stuff going on. So it was a fun run, but also trying to make some money. And that, you know, that was elusive, I think, for everybody in the early going. I mean, we all were really good at what we were doing.
And what's interesting is that in those early days, we would always look to each other for those sort of things, you know, and try to figure out how to help each other through that. Okay. 3, 2, 1. Okay, so we had a little bit of a power outage there, but we're back. And Bob was talking about the early technology and how, you know, at times he leveraged his graphics background and his internet knowledge. And it's, again, parallels, man. I remember back then we would all vie for that Yahoo top site of the month or Netscape's cool site of the day.
Lycos top 5% of the web.
Yeah, and that's back before algorithms, meaning there were people curating those lists. And man, it was
Alta Vista.
It was a knife fight to get those people to recognize you, and it was a big deal when they did. I remember Gridiron Grumblings back then when I was running it. I would kill for one of those because it would triple, quadruple my traffic once those guys decided to sort of touch you on the shoulder, right? And you were right. We were kind of competitive in a weird way.
Frenemies.
Frenemies, yeah, for the most part, frenemies. It was cutthroat. Let's not get it wrong. But certain people, like William and I, go back 20, 25 years, and he would always send me a note like, hey, I just stole your idea for podcasting, before it was called podcasting, right? Or like, hey, I like what you did on that page. I got my text working on it, you know, or whatever. Like you said, frenemies, and some people better than others, but I think it was the spirit of cooperation because we did get the sense that we were building an industry.
I think that was 100% it. We all realized we all felt the same. Like this was going to be our key to fame and fortune, and you know, we were all completely wrong about that. I think I've been in it 30 years. I'm about 5 years away from breaking even. But still, I mean, like, you know, some of the things, you know, we did, we were super innovative along the way. Many of us, like, you know, one of the things I did early on that really, you know, kept me alive was I got a 900 number and I would read the box scores off CompuServe into my 900 number. That paid the bills year round.
Right.
Like, you know, everyone at that period of time had to wait till Monday when the USA Today came out to score their leagues.
Right.
Well, they could call my 900 number and do it Sunday night and get a little jump. And you know how important that is in, you know, to people in this game to know everything in the moment. That was really what carried me through the first few years, and kept me in cans of corn and whatnot and kept me going.
Yeah, and the next, I think, phase for a lot of us, and I think certainly for you, tell me if you disagree or not, was I think as internet journalists, let's use that phrase right now, sports journalists, fantasy sports journalists, at least for me, it was the craving to be accepted as a real thing. Like I always looked down on when you had like the Don Bankses, and I say Don Banks not because I know him personally, but his work in particular always irked me because he would go out of his way to demean fantasy football back in the day. How much did you have that sort of desire to say, hey man, I want to get that press pass when I call the Cardinals or whatever team you happen to be with, or why can't I get in on a presser? I have questions too. And how happy were you when you met ML Cadillac, and maybe that afforded you the opportunity by getting into print journalism? How did that tie in?
It helped a little bit. I got in before that. Okay. I'm going to tell you how. I had 800 numbers. I realized the phone was the way to do business. I started calling teams to get information, and they were really fed up with fantasy managers calling them trying to get information. I explained to many of them what I was doing. So by the end of 1996, if you called a I want to say 25 or so of the teams. All they do is give you my phone number. And you said the word fantasy or asked a fantasy question.
Right.
They loved me. The Kansas City Chiefs, when Joe Montana was having the ailing elbow at a period, I believe one of the PR ladies named a kid after me. They would get inundated with calls. Pretty soon, and newspapers would start doing the same thing. Like they were sick of getting their sports desk inundated with calls from people wanting to know about so-and-so's injury. And so they would just give out my 800 number, and I would take those calls, and I would try to sell people with varying degrees or not of success. But that kind of gave me a pretty good in. I also was pretty adept at getting in on the press conferences. When they started doing the teleconferences, I always had the number, and I was always able to get in, and nobody really knew. So you just ask reasonable questions. But I think the bigger point there is, like, I don't know if I needed to be accepted. Well, I think I said something at my FSWA Hall of Fame speech, which, by the way, record setter, 2.5 minutes. I believe that's the shortest in the history of Hall of Fame speeches. But I think the big key for me was, as somebody who just started doing this, I worked hard not to look like somebody who just started doing this, right? I mean, I wanted to, and so where was my training? I didn't go to journalism school, none of those things, but boy, every Friday I was at the mailbox waiting for my dad's Sports Illustrated to show up. I read like crazy, constantly, not just Sports Illustrated, but books on sports, Strange But Two football stories, Xander Hollander, You're the Greatest. I want to say avid, but that's like a huge understatement, a voracious reader and, a reasonably good mimic and, kind of could come across as like I half-assed knew what I was doing. So that helped along the way. It also helps. I mean, the point came, I think, John, I want to say 97, 98, when the NFL kind of realized, oh, those people spend money, right? And they started blowing a little wind into the promotional sale, or at least didn't treat it like it was gambling,
right?
Which was not so cool at the time in the NFL circle. So the combination of the internet, the proliferation, and the ability to get your information out there, and the fact that the league started accepting it, I want to say I talked to Don Banks like shortly before he passed away, and he passed away suddenly, unexpectedly. I think guys came around. I wrote for Sports Illustrated. I was, I think, the first person to have a fantasy column there in 2000, 2002, I want to say. And I wrote there for about 6 years, and it felt like super cool. Like, wow, look, I write the same place that Peter King does, right? And I would quote him and, get a chance to interact, minimally. But, wasn't ever felt like I was looked down upon or anything at that point. So, and then Peter King famously, began dispensing horrible fantasy advice.
Right.
I think we all have our lane. I never really looked at it as like, hey, I'm competing with those people. I kind of looked at it as we do different things, but I did want to come across as professional in my presentation and my tone and things like that. So you do want to have some level of credibility and professionalism is where that comes from. However, whether it's the presentation of the information itself, how it looks, it's the way you create the information, how you write it, how you talk to people. I think all those things, the communication of ideas is, to me, the key to almost any success you're going to have in life in general, anything you're doing.
Right.
Like, it's great to have ideas. It's great if they're great ideas. Also, if you can't share those ideas effectively with other people and convince them that they're great ideas, you're probably not going to go very far. So yeah. I think to me, that's a super important part of all this and a skill that shouldn't be overlooked for anyone doing anything out there.
Yeah. I tend to agree with you. And I think there's this thing that sometimes if you see someone who's successful in any field, but especially in like fantasy sports journalism, the temptation was to try to do it exactly like them. So if you were a fan of Matthew Berry's, you were like, okay, I got to write with Snark. I got to do whatever, whatever. And if you were a friend of Kellogg's, you had to put in Greg Kellogg, by the way, who we've also had the pleasure of interviewing here. You tended to mimic how Greg wrote his columns, right? If he had a little bit of success in early on. And I think that's the toughest thing. And to your point, I would give advice to anyone is find your voice, but also be able to communicate clearly, because I think a lot of what we have to say now is, especially when things are so instantaneous.
I think there's a couple aspects to that that are super important. Number one, I think I see today a lot of people creating content for other content creators. You're trying to you know, look good amongst the group. And I think you need to keep in mind who your audience is. I think that's been, you know, if there's anything I've done reasonably well over the course of my time, it's understanding that everyone who listens, writes, reads, watches anything I do is pretty sure they could do what I'm doing slightly better than I could do it if it were not for some quirk of fate that kept them from doing it. I don't know, totally disagree with that, right? As someone who just started doing this. And, you know, it's a great audience. We are selling ice to Eskimos. They are the best informed audience out there, right? That you're not fooling anybody with anything. So, like, I mean, one of the things I do is, like, I'm going on a local radio. I, like, you do local radio hits all the time. Like, I try, you know, okay, I'm going on Buffalo. I try to have something in my hand that's, like, a piece of information that any fan of Buffalo would know. Wow, that's a, you know, probably not something the whole world knows, but we all know, right? Like, you've got to convince this audience, and how you do that is you be genuine and you try not to fool them, because you can't. They know when you're fooling them, and they will pick up on it quickly. So, you know, being knowledgeable, being steeped in the subject is still the most important aspect of all this, because that's the way you look like you know what you're doing. And again, you're mostly preaching to a choir. And I've learned over my time on Sirius, we take tons of calls. I do tons of live streams with football guys and did with football diehards. You know, you're taking questions from people. I think every question is really the same question. I'm crazy to play X over X, right? I mean, I think everyone knows. Right. And so, you know, trying to, you know, help them understand, you know, the range of outcomes with any given player, and that, no, you're not crazy. Maybe it's not advisable, but play your hunch over my hunch, but here's my hunch. You know, kind of having that give and take with the audience is really important to me. And I think it's why I'm still doing this, even though I'm pretty much old and irrelevant in general. I think remaining relevant in this game is like understanding what the audience is after, what they want, and what they think of themselves. It's very important.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. And I think from my own experience, what I used to do is, my background is one of data analysis. I mean, that's, you know, what I went to school for. That's what I ended up doing professionally, basically. And I had a lot of trouble initially, because my first sort of fantasy stuff was all around, like, here's the probability of X. There's the probability of Y. And to me, it was perfectly clear. Right. If I gave you 10 players in descending probable order, it didn't mean that I thought that's how they would end up. I just said, here's the best likelihood of what I think coming. And initially what fueled my site back in the day was people arguing with me, right? Like, how could you say that? Look at what happened last week or whatever. And that's when it kind of dawned on me, oh, they really either don't understand or I'm not communicating to them exactly what I mean, right?
Yeah, that.
And I think that was key for me initially, right? And it led to opportunities. It led to me doing those, like you said, local sports talk hits, right, where you'd call in every Tuesday, whether it was Baltimore or Atlanta or whatever. And, you know, and by the way, I did correct my inauthenticity, Bob. I have to tell you that, for example, whenever I called the New Orleans station or the Atlanta station, for some dumb reason, I'd find myself saying y'all a lot. And I'm a native New Yorker, born and raised in the Bronx, never left the Bronx for my entire life. And I find myself saying things like y'all or whatever. And I said to myself, oh, wow, even though I wasn't doing it on purpose, I could see where it would come across as being completely fucking authentic.
Christ, man.
There? All right. Now, one of the things I want to talk to you about, Bob, is your friend and partner for many years, Emil Tadlec. Back in the day, I have to tell you, one of the things, like a lot of us aspired to, especially when we hadn't met each other face-to-face initially, was being featured in one of Emil's magazines. It's something you work towards. Like, you had a sense that you had made it if you had gotten into one of Emil's magazines. And I had the opportunity to initially meet him. I think it was 96 or 97 at one of the conventions, and like a typical football nerd, I had come with my stats presentation printed out and handed it to Emil and said, here, I think you should print this, you know. And of course, what I handed him was probably bigger than the magazine. But from that moment on, though, we did communicate, and I have to say I was lucky enough to be included in several of his magazines over the years. And that gave me the experience to become an editor for the Harris Publications, unfortunately a competitor of Emil's, but, you know, to get into that print game as well. Talk to me a little bit about Emil, who unfortunately passed away recently. Talk to me a little bit about Emil. What kind of person was he, the effect he had on your career, any other memories you want to share of him?
So I put the first year I did this, I put advertising in USA Today to get calls and get customers, and it was very effective. And one of those calls was a guy who said, "Hey, I do magazines. Maybe you want to advertise with me too." And I think that's how a lot of people got to know Emil. But right. The first phone call with Emil was probably 8 hours long. Most phone calls with Emil were a minimum of 3 hours for everybody, right? Like, I mean, he was just talkative, and he would listen to your issues. He would share ideas. But he was a true innovator in the space. And I think, you know, the thing that's interesting, he worked his way through college in the 70s at a record store. So he had this great knowledge, vast knowledge of arcane music. If you liked Russ Ballard or Argent or Todd Rundgren or just about anyone, you know, right. Jeff Lynne and Electric Light Orchestra. He loved all that. He worked at a place called Red Top Records and Tapes in Albuquerque. Worked his way through college, where he got a master's degree in electrical engineering. He became a nuclear engineer. So he's working at Sandia National Labs, inventing things. There are still patents in his name today. Gainful employment that he decided, I want to say in 1988 or 89, he was going to go and do this fantasy magazine. And much to the chagrin and consternation of friends, family, et cetera. And he started doing it. And from 1990 on, he printed a magazine every year through last year. And not just one, but eventually we had five titles out there. And along the way, though, I mean, he never stopped innovating. He was always thinking of new things. He came up with the whole idea of high stakes fantasy football with Lenny Pepano. They created the World Championship of Fantasy Football, I want to say in 2002. I can remember at the time wondering, wow, this is crazy. They're going to give away $250,000. Well, first you have to, you know, have the intestinal fortitude to just like quitting a job as a nuclear engineer and to make a magazine that maybe 100 people might buy. You're going to give $250,000 away to, I don't know, people who are going to spend $1,000 to play in a fantasy football league an event in Las Vegas. They did everything right. It was fantastic, super successful company that is now mimicked and, you know, pretty much the norm at high stakes events every year from a number of companies. And so over the course of time, Emil was just a guy who came up with great ideas. He was not afraid to borrow ideas and make them his own and put his own mark on them. He had a keen eye on the history of the game, really pushed the notion. I think there was a lot of talk out there for a period of time how fantasy football started, you know, kind of alongside fantasy baseball. Well, it really didn't. Fantasy football started in the 60s, early 60s, with a group of people associated with the Oakland Raiders.
Winklebaugh.
But all that aside, you know, he drove to get those guys recognized, the original founders in the FSGA now. It was the FSTA, Fantasy Sports Trade Association. So he just had a keen eye on the history. You can go to his site right now. He has a site called FantasyNation.com. It's probably still alive. Or he did interviews with probably 30, 40 different people who are early on I'm sure there's one of you, John. Or early on where...
Oh, actually, we never got to it. It's one of the regrets of my life.
Yeah.
We had it scheduled and then, you know, life happened and we just never got to it. Yeah.
So just like a huge force who launched the number of careers launched. You know, one of the things I, you know, think about when I look back at my time in this industry was having a hand in giving people platforms. And I did have a hand in that, but I did it off the back of Emil Cadlick. Who was really the guy providing these platforms, whether it was online or in print. And as you said, I mean, people really appreciate the opportunity to be in print and you know, gain a name. And Emil was out there, I mean, you know, doing things that other people weren't doing in ways other people weren't doing it. And it just it was a great to work alongside him. We were a small company, just the two of us, basically. Bill Robertson also kind of involved in the business end of things, but Emil Cadlick, you know, eventually – you know, kind of took over the technical aspects that I had been handling, and I ended up doing pretty much the content end of things, and we kind of went from there. So we did some really cool stuff. We were the first, you know, first people. He took us to a seminar we were the first people in the industry to use, you know, database-based web design, right? Dynamic, made on the fly web pages where we put our articles into databases. I mean, no one else in the fantasy business was doing that in the late 90s. It took down, like, I used to have to create a web page every time I wrote an article. Well, there was a point where I was writing 50, 60 articles a day. If you could have that done automatically, it was pretty handy. So just a great guy. I think, like, I tell this story because I think it's interesting. You know, a couple things. My, you know, the quirky things about Emil, B-rated chess player. He's a super high-end chess player. But just a quirky, weird, really smart guy. He did the bare-knuckle challenge draft, you know, where you draft without a cheat sheet. You can't, you know, duplicate any picks. There's no electronics allowed to do the proceedings. And he just a draft board. And he did it blindfolded. And I think he missed one error in round 21. He picked somebody who had already been picked. I mean, he's just a quirky guy. But like, you know, his love of fantasy kind of reflected around. He, in 2006, he made a website called MariaJulianPottery.com. He found this, like, this interest in local New Mexican Native American Indian pottery, and he became immersed in that world. Like, he went out, he interviewed the artists and the families of the artists, right. And he started promoting their work. He was working on a book of it when he passed away. But he translated marriage records from this San Ildefonso tribe in near Santa Fe, and it just, like, it was amazing, and it just reflected the same thing he did in fantasy. He found something he was super interested in, kind of made it his objective to learn all he could about it and put the information out there for people to see. So that's kind of, you know, his off-field activities reflected the same kind of thing he did on the field, and just a remarkable guy to work with. I feel very fortunate. Literally, you know, pulled me out of, you know, nowhere. I was at the point where, I mean, I had about hit bottom in terms of not making enough money to turn this into a business, and was pretty much thinking of stopping. And he said, let's figure something out. And that was about 98. He came and picked me up, and we went to New Mexico. I lived there for about 20 years after that. But, you know, and I'd been working with him before that, but kind of as a freelancer, but took me on and just, you know, like, I think I can safely say, you know, when you think of the handful of people who've had an impact on your life, it's your parents. He's probably next on the list for me, right? He just, like, changed the whole trajectory of my life by having some faith in me and my ability to create content. I had faith in him and his ability to monetize that content, and it worked out really well.
And what's interesting about Emil was he never struck me as a boisterous type or somebody who ran around saying, look at me, look at me. He was actually, from what I could tell, Bob, tell me if I'm wrong, like a reserved kind of fellow, and like he would talk to I do remember that aspect, that the few times we corresponded a lot, but like I think face to face we might have met a handful of times, just like say at the annual FSWA conventions or something like that, but always had time for you, you know, like, yeah. he would always, like, you I don't know how serious you were about the 3-hour phone call, but But I mean, like, I remember every time I sat up, he, hey, John, what's up? You know, like, hey, what are you doing this year? How's your site going? Hey, are you still working on those probabilities? You know, or always took the time to make you feel like, hey, he at least is paying attention to me.
He remembers everything, right? Like, it's a skill that he had, and he remembered every single thing. So if you were talking about something, and look, he was competitive. He had an edge to him. You didn't see that. Right. It wasn't forward facing, but I mean, it drove him, and it's, you know, what keeps you in business in a tough competitive industry, for over 30 years, and doing it at a very high level. So, you know, I'm just can't tell you how fortunate I am to have, you know, sometimes you meet someone in your life who the pieces just fit. Right. And then the skills that you both share kind of fit kind of tongue and groove in there. And that was kind of how we worked out. And also, you know, actually getting along with that person. Wow. Imagine that makes it even easier. So, just a great guy who did wonderful things for a number of people and helped an industry kind of come into its own.
Yeah. And like we said, RIP, a good guy. And it's rare that you run across good guys, especially in this industry. I don't mean to say that people are like horrible people, but you know, when you start an industry, it is things like you said, like how long can I last before I run out of money?
And right.
Do I, you know, it's something I'm passionate about, but if I can't feed my family, I'm going to have to get out. So that leads to the competitiveness, to a sort of cutthroat attitude. The people who can do that and still be kind to others, you can count on one hand in this industry.
Nah, I agree with that.
And I don't consider myself part of the industry anymore because I basically retired in 2019 from the industry. But having spent almost 25 years in it, I can honestly say Emil and maybe three or four others that I interacted with on a business level where I could say, hey, they weren't out to put a knife in your back. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, absolutely true. All right, Bob. So let me move on a little bit and ask you about this. It seems to me like fantasy sports journalism, especially, and the industry in general, either has been on the bleeding edge of technology implementation or very close behind it. Starting out, like you said, from the old days, taking the USA Today, transcribing things by hand, the spreadsheet, like Excel, was a huge innovation, right?
It was.
Back in the day. So, you know, and a lot of people listening to this might be like, that's nuts, you know? But if you consider, like, so what would you say in total, let's take, you know, whether it was print, radio, internet, social media, apps, whatever you want to categorize it at, talk to me a little bit about technology and fantasy sports in general, and maybe even what do you feel was the biggest push for the industry that legitimized fantasy sports?
The internet was the starting point, and I want to say, you know, it started gaining momentum in 96, but the thing that changed the way the game is played and perceived and grew was commissioner software. I want to say the CBS commissioner, commissioner.com, some of those early things. Like the thing that allowed people to connect, that like up until that point, you had to have 12 people who were, or some number of people who were interested in creating a league, would show up for things. You could work their schedule together to all get in the right. same place at the same time. The commissioner software changed all that, and it also opened the door to ease of like running a league, right? Like you didn't have to sit there with the USA Today for 2 days, you know, working everyone's scores, and it ended a lot of the arguments that came from miscalculations and things like that. So to me, the proliferation of the internet and commissioner software was a huge game changer. But that fueled the growth of the industry. So the industry itself, though, the change was more smart people started jumping in, right? Not guys who were just doing this, but like actual data scientists, people with backgrounds in that, people, lawyers, people, professional people who had great careers, who found ways to, you know, who took an interest in sport, but had skills that kind of dovetailed with what they needed to be in fantasy football. I know the person I work for now, Joe Bryant, has been in this industry a long time, published his first article in a magazine back in 1996, I want to say, on value-based drafting, kind of changed the way a lot of people looked at the game. But he jokes, but he's not 100% wrong. Like, he goes, I don't know if I could get a job at my own website today, right? Like, I mean, it's just the tide has shifted in the ability of people to use data, manipulate data, display data has grown in by leaps and bounds. And so I think for me, the big challenge has been, you know, keeping up with the huge influx of really smart people. And there's tons of people who I enjoy their work, but one of the things I've done all along is I'm not out there being an innovative thinker. My job is connecting all those things together and presenting it to an audience that doesn't have time to go out there and sort through everything. And so I think that gave me a little bit of an edge, or the ability to stay in this business was, look, I'm just putting the information together and sharing that information and showing people what's possible and available from some of those smart minds, and not being afraid to like give someone credit for being a smart mind is a pretty good starting point. I think that's something that Emil and I both shared, was like, hey, we could have done magazines that were narrow and only used our people and our own content. And I said, no, that's not what we want to do. We want to spread this out. We want to, you know, and one of the things I did early on with the web was I put links up to everybody's website. Right. Like, I think I was the first, certainly fantasy site doing that, because Well, at first it was because I was arrogant. I was going, I want everyone to see what else everyone else is doing and then come back and say, man, I'm going back to that guy. He's doing it right. Whether that was true or not, I mean, that was the impetus. But over time, it just became obvious that, like, you're not going to hide things from people. You might as well get in front of sharing it and using it to help people get better at the game, because that's really the end. You know, that's the goal. That's what my audience wants. They want to be better. So if there's information out there or that other people create or whatever, I'm happy to turn them on to those other people, incorporate their work in my work, give them the due credit for the efforts they make, and, you know, kind of build and compile a bigger batch, a bigger picture information based on some of the data points they're sharing. But that's been a huge shift in the whole, you know, the way things work is we have gained and continue to gain really smart people. And now there's different avenues to go into, whether it's the media aspects, the video, the audio, things like that. You know, and I'm not afraid to jump into all those. I do all that. But there are people who are legitimately good at it. You'll try to learn from them and become more like them. And it's been a really interesting journey to see, like, the thing that we kind of, like, the kind of I envisioned, and I know you did as well, like, we need to be an industry or something. I mean, we've become that. And glad that I could latch on and hang on to, you know, the portion that I've got. But it's not easy because the people coming in are not, you know, they're not fooling around. They're doing really cool stuff.
Yeah, and it's funny that you mentioned that because you mentioned Joe Bryant. And I remember Joe Bryant as well coming to my site and saying, like, hey, do you mind publishing this article for me? You know, I'd love to provide you an article if you promote my VBD, value-based drafting. I said, sure, you know, whatever. Back, because I started my site full-time in 95. So, you know, he was trying to get his site started, you know, and that's the sort of, like, camaraderie you had back then. You know, I could have just as easily said, nah, go build. And people forget, having a domain name back then was not a cheap proposition, right? It was like $300-$400 just to get a domain name, to set up a website. There was, you know, you had to know how to code. You couldn't just do it, you know, like these 10 minutes on GoDaddy and you have your site, right? So it took a little bit of expertise, and that was a barrier to entry, right? But even now, like, to Joe's point though, I doubt I could, like, I started football analytics and I was one of the first handful that would go on the site and say, you know, here's a coefficient of variance. Here's how you calculate it. Here's how you apply it. Here's a statistical anomaly as opposed to, something within range, you know, or whatever. Look at what, like, what is it, Pro Football Focus does, or you know,
any number of pros.
Yeah, and you're like
Hansen's site, John Hansen's site now. Like, there are tons of them out there that are doing those kind of things, and it's all great stuff.
Oh, it's great stuff. But to your point, could I get a job with them now? At the point when people used to come to me and say, "How do you figure this out?" Now it's like, oh my God, depth of target, a percentage of, you know, like, first of all, the data collection ability is amazing now. Whereas before, we were, targets was an innovation in 95, 96. You couldn't find those numbers, right? Because they weren't kept. And now you have better data collection. I think people underestimate that, what that brought, just the ability to have this data at your fingertips, right?
Next gen stats have come along and have enabled an entire world, an entire universe of really accurate numbers of a broad variety. I mean, it's really been amazing. There's people out there that have, like, really leveraged that well. You mentioned Pro Football Focus. I want to say early on, Mike Clay now with ESPN was doing their fantasy stuff early, inventing statistics, average depth of target, things like that that had an impact on fantasy numbers. There's guys, you know, out there, Curtis Patrick and the RotoViz site, all the guys at RotoViz doing amazing work. And I don't want to start calling people out because I'll leave people off the list. Sure. They totally deserve to be in it. But it's, you know, some of those analytics and, you know, statistical sites have done a really good job. And I think they've all, you know, served their purpose for the rest of us who go out there and use those stats. And Fantasy Pros is a great example of that you mentioned. So, yeah, it's a fast changing universe. And you know, the way we put the word out there has changed, whether it's gone through audio. You mentioned Greg Kellogg. Greg and I, in 1998, did something called the TFL Report webcast. Real audio broadcast. How we had to do that, so we would write out a script over the phone. I would send Greg his part. He would record his part. I would get it back. I would put together, edit together a conversation, just piece by piece, put music behind it. Like, it would take a day to put together a 20-minute broadcast, right? So the ease with which you can now jump in your StreamYard and just have a conversation like we're doing now, or just broadcasting live on YouTube or Instagram or whatever.
Right.
You know, the changes that have come and the ease with which we could actually create this content has been remarkable. Now, you know, the kind of editing tools, and of course, you know, we can get into the AI if you want, but the use of that to, you know, better pinpoint how you should schedule your content. You know, you mentioned earlier, we're all battling the analytics. We're all battling the algorithms at Google, trying to garner a bit of attention on YouTube or whatever, or TikTok. All that is, you know, that's as big a part of this as anything now. And there's people who are really good at that as well. So some smart people in that world.
Yeah. And it's funny how things evolve. Right. And you know, what's interesting, you just triggered a memory for me. I think I was the first one to syndicate fantasy football content to talk sports talk back in the late 90s. It was called Fantasy Football Minute. And it was old school. You got your Rolodex of contacts of PDs, and I would send out 1,000 of these emails at no cost. I just went to say sponsored by Gridiron Grumblings. 1 minute of audio that I recorded. Like if someone had a camera, you'd think it was ridiculous, right? I'd have my little Radio Shack microphone talking into a tape deck and recording 1 minute, exactly 1 minute. And timing myself and having the intro and all that, and then putting it together in real audio, then sending it out to say 500 or so stations that were running it, right? And it had to be there by the next morning or else they couldn't deal with it. And you had specs. And like you said, it might take all day to prepare a 1 minute.
You were doing shorts before shorts were a thing.
I like I say, sometimes I think I was born 25 years too early, Bob, with a lot of this stuff, right? Podcasting as well. You know, you're talking about real audio. I don't know if you did or not, but I remember having to build my own IceCaster server because there were no audio serving. There were no machines that served audio natively. So I had to build my own and host it myself in order to do the equivalent of podcasting. So it is fantastic. Would you advise someone, that's a great question, would you advise someone who wants to get into, say, fantasy sports journalism or gaming as something being adjacent to that, would you advise them to learn the technology first or the communication first? Or I'm assuming the love of sport has to be there, right? So I'm giving that as a granted. But would you recommend that they first become better communicators or better technologists? Like 30 years ago, we would have said better communicators. Do you think that's still the case?
I think that's still what's going to set you apart. I mean, in a world where the technology is starting to do itself, literally, I think the thing that's going to continue to stand out, people are going to gravitate to the personalities, the voices they like. And, I mean, there's even going to come a point where those voices are going to be created artificially or can be. Oh, yeah, we're already there. But that's, you know, one of the advantages that people have been doing this a while have. We have a trusted, loyal audience. You have to build that. I think that's important, but technology is going to be part of that. And so you can't, you know, I don't think you can do one without the other, but if you're asking me if you had to focus on one, it's hone your voice, get your reps in and establish yourself as an engaging personality who people will gravitate towards. That's, I mean, I know that sounds, it's probably easier said than done, but I think that's a big part of the goal, because the amount of content that's going to be published in coming years that's going to be easily published and proliferated without any issues at all is going to be really frightening. And so, you know, I say frightening, you know, only from the perspective of the person who creates content or is trying to get in the business of creating content. For the audience, it's going to be a great thing. It's going to democratize this. You're going to be able to basically create your own content based on the things that you like, right? And the people you like. You'll be able to corral up the words and work of people you enjoy very easily. And so I think there's going to be a coming shift. But if I was just getting in this business and hope to stick around a while, I would work on that voice and the personality and building an audience and a following that appreciates what you do. I think that's going to be really important.
Yeah, I agree with you, because my feeling is you can't buy personality, but you could buy technology help. Do you know what I mean? Like, you could hire someone to do the web design. You could hire someone to build you an app. You can't hire someone to give you a personality. At least not yet, Bob, in my opinion.
Not
maybe,
yet.
Maybe 10 years from now, that'll be the case. But right now,
it's going to change quickly, Sean. I'm going to tell you that. And the things that you need to hire people to do are going to do themselves. The creation of sites, the creation of apps, things like that. We're already on the cusp of that. It's a reality. It's maybe not as widespread as it will be in 6 months, a year and a half, 2 years. Tomorrow. It's growing by leaps and bounds. So, you want to be in front of that. I keep, telling people, what are you doing with the AI? Well, I'm trying not to be a candlestick maker when the incandescent bulb shows up, right? I want to at least understand what the hell's going on and be able to use this new tool that's going to be very helpful to all of us, but also could, knock us all out of the way if we're not careful or not ready for it. So I would be learning that portion of the technology, but also work on your voice, work on your message, build your following. I think that's going to be key. You can go out on the YouTube and look at various channels or go to the podcast and see who's listening to what, and you'll see that there are people who have been consistently successful by building these audiences. And I don't think the technology is going to change that portion of it.
Right. I tend to agree with you. And being someone who's been technologically inclined my whole life, I agree with you. I think, you can't ignore technology, or if you do, you do so at your own peril. But to the extent that I think you could become an engaging character, an engaging personality, you should, right?
100%.
And that's where you need to be. All right. Bob, let me ask you this. Heading into next season, what kind of advice are you going to give folks heading into this football season, do you think?
I'm going to tell people to diversify. Like, so for people like me that I'm already in the best ball rooms drafting many teams. I'll have 1,000 teams by the time the season starts. Diversify. Don't get locked in on single players. First bit of advice is listen to your own advice. That's for me. Every year we learn a bunch of lessons from the previous season. And you start out in early drafts and you're following that advice. And then as you get closer to the season, you start retreating into your old defensive positions and the ways that you've always done things because it's comfortable. Right. Get uncomfortable. Figure things out. Don't be afraid to be different than the other people in your league. You don't have to draft based on the ADP that's presented to you on the platform you're drafting on. Have your own list ready. Feel comfortable going with guys you want. But don't get locked in on single takes. I think the big thing we do wrong is we need to understand that everything is an evolution. Even being right and wrong. Like, I can be right and wrong and right again about the same player over a short period of time. So just be open to that crazy notion that being right and wrong is not necessarily what you're doing. You're looking at a range of outcomes, play to that range of outcomes, play the high end of the range, build rosters. You can have risk on a roster without having a risky roster, right? You mitigate, just like you do with other things. So I think the big thing for me is don't get locked in on a single player. If you're in a single league, right? And like, I know there's a lot of people out there going, why are you playing in 1,000 leagues? Why are you drafting now? Stop that, sir. And I get that. For me, drafting is like lifting weights. You exercise those muscles so that when you get to the drafts that matter most, when August hits, boom, you're picking guys. There's never a panic pick. You're never caught short because you've been in 1,000 drafts, right? Literally, that becomes a reflexive move. But that doesn't mean you can't take advantage of some of the things, even if you play in like one league that matters. Go out there and get some mock drafts. Sleeper has one. You can jump in for no money and just work through them. I prefer the best balls because there's a little bit of money on the line and people take them a little more seriously. It's a little different strategy and you have to shift into regular season mode, redraft mode. But I think that's the big issue is it's your team. You get to play it how you want. Don't listen to people like me tell you you're stupid because you'll never hear me say that because I don't think any of you are, right? Like, have a little faith and play your hunches. Don't be afraid to look foolish or do things that maybe don't align with what the group think in your league or a batch of experts thinks. Set your own ideas up and then go out and test them in mock drafts and see like maybe you really love a player and you say, well, I'm willing to draft him in the first round. Well, you go out and you do a couple mock drafts, say, well, nobody's drafting him until the fourth round.
Right.
you can wait a little bit and get great value and draft another player that also gives you huge upside. Right. So, you know, trust the players that you trust in, but learn how to price them appropriately. And like, there's so many approaches to the game and so many ways to end up winning. I think the key is being yourself, trusting your knowledge, going out and testing that knowledge in various ways, whether it's interacting with people like me or, you know, playing with in challenging leagues or trying different scoring systems, all those things. But just have a good time with it. And just remember, it's your team in the end. Nobody remembers who comes in second place. Only people right. remember. Only thing people remember is who the champion was at the end of the year. So take your chances, take big swings. Don't be afraid to, you know, to come up short. You know, and maybe that's not your style. Maybe your style is totally, hey, I'm playing it safe. I'm going get good at what you like to do and carry it through.
That's great advice, Bob. Not just in football, fantasy football, but I think in life in general. That's great
for
advice.
Sure.
All right, so we've come to that point of the conversation, Bob, where I do something called silly questions.
Okay.
There's absolutely no right or wrong answers. These are just ways for people to get to know a little bit more about you. Okay. Silly question number one. If you had to pick one fictional character to manage your fantasy team, who would it be?
It would be Tom Brady era Bill Belichick.
Okay. Tom Brady era Bill Belichick. Fair enough. Why is that?
He knew how to build around a great piece and add complementary pieces that got the job done with the superstar piece. And I think, like in fantasy, you don't get all the guys you want, right? You get one or two guys that you really want, and then you have to add those pieces around them that buttress them and hold them up. I think that's a great skill to have, and it's one that he seemed to have when he had the superstar.
Right, when he had the superstar, everything else seemed to be a lot better for him. Okay, great. This happened to me on the radio once, spectacularly, and I had a hard time living it down. What's the worst fantasy football advice you've ever given? Like a very specific piece of advice, not a general one.
I'll go to last year, and I advised people to draft Anthony Richardson in the fifth round of their drafts. I did it way more times. Did I mention I'm going to diversify more? He would be one of the reasons why I'm going to diversify a little more. He became an auto pick.
Fair enough.
It was a huge upside play. I felt like the cost was right, but you know those things could be failures. I also advise people to mitigate that risk because it was a risk, because there's always a range of quarterbacks who are available as quarterback twos who can save your bacon. This year, all those quarterback twos weren't as good as they normally have been in the past, right? So that made it a little bit more of a struggle. So hopefully more people drafted Jaden Daniels in round nine than they did Anthony Richardson in round five. But I'll go with that because it's easy to go with the recency.
Fair enough. And just to show you that I'm human as well, I have to say this is when I was still doing regular guest slots on the Ron and Fez show on Sirius XM. Okay. It was the gig I had before I got my own show on Sirius, before Steve Cohen picked up the phone and called me. And I remember advising Ron Bennington saying, you got to start Tony Romo this week, Ron. I guarantee you he's going to go off. Four touchdowns at least. Long story short, he broke his clavicle in the first quarter of the fall that coming weekend. So very so public.
You throw injuries out, though, man. You can't control that, John. I mean, that's I'm not going to take the hit on that.
But I was uncharacteristically bold and aggressive, you know, which is not my personality. But anyway, that always sticks out in my mind at least. But anyway, very good. What's your guilty pleasure TV show that people would be shocked to find out that you watch?
It's probably not TV. It's YouTube drum porn. I'm a lifelong okay. drummer, and so I okay. watch drumming videos endlessly. I mean, endlessly. That's how I escape from things, and okay. and it's like there's not even any guilt to it. I happily acknowledge that I have a problem with watching YouTube drum videos way more than I should.
Is that the one, like, I know there's one that guy, I think he's an Argentinian guy.
Oh, no, he's a I think Portuguese, Estefario Sibierno.
That guy's amazing.
He's not drumming. He's doing something else. I watch the hell out of him. But whatever that is he's doing, as someone who's played drums for over 50 years, that's not exactly what we do.
Wow, but it's amazing, whatever it is that he does.
He's incredible, and I love watching him.
Excellent, excellent. What's the most ridiculous fantasy football team name you've ever seen, and what's the cleverest?
I'm gonna go with Mike Inez in the band Alice in Chains. I host on Sirius the Alice in Chains and Friends Fantasy League, Charity League drafts.
Right.
And I will say, Mike Inez comes up with the most creative names. Los Testiculos El Diablos was one of his winners. Otis Sistrunk's Thick Ham Candle would be another one. He's putting it out there. Clever. I mean, there's so many clever ones. I don't know if I don't name any of my teams. My teams are all, hey, my team or Team Harris or whatever. But there have been some super clever ones over the years. I wish I could think of a really good one that would like stand out above the rest.
Right. Okay. And to wrap up, what's the most surprising thing you've learned about yourself playing fantasy football?
That I'm incredibly reasonable. Right? Like, nobody would accuse me of this. I think nobody who knows me in real life would accuse me of being calm, rational, or reasonable or any of those things. I think I found a lane in playing fantasy football and in my presentation. I mean, I want to be reasonable. I don't want to have hot takes. I don't want to hot take myself into things. I want to have some rationale behind everything I discuss, talk about, and do. And I think that's over time, I figured that out. Like, I know in an industry where everyone's looking for attention, it's really cool to go out there with hot takes. I don't think that, like, and I'm not against it. I mean, have a hot take. Anthony Richardson was a pretty hot take last year in round five. But I think I backed it up with some pretty rational, reasonable thoughts and some plans to mitigate the risk that didn't work out as much as I'd like. But I think that's kind of become something that I think is really important. Like, in a world where everyone's craving attention, everyone's out there on the far edges of things, in all things in life, right? I mean, like, the loudest voices are the ones that are promoting the narrowest band of information and trying to get all the attention. I want to be down the middle. That doesn't mean you have to be boring, unexciting, uninteresting. You can be all those things, but be reasonable. Realize what your audience is. Realize what they're after and what they need. They don't need you to make outrageous claims and take outrageous stances and plant flags that are unsustainable or unreasonable to support, right? They need you out there to help them make the decisions that are best, that are going to help them lead the winning seasons. And I think, you know, helping them understand that every player has a range of outcomes. And within a reason, you could say that there's going to be great success or a whopping failure within the same week with the same player. Helping people understand that has kind of been, I think, what's kept me going in this business. So I want to say that I've learned that being reasonable is really the path to success. Imagine that. Who would have thought, like, in today's world, that being reasonable has any place in it?
Right. All right. Bob Harris, thank you so much for your time today. Give us a shout out. Where can people find your work? Where can they find you?
They can find me at footballguys.com. My work there, I write articles throughout the offseason. You'll find me on the Audible channel there, on their YouTube channel, doing video work there. You can find me on SiriusXM Fantasy Sports Radio. Once the season starts, you can almost not avoid me. I'll be on 7 days a week as usual, including on NFL Radio. We do a show there once a week too. So catch me on the pregame show and catch me on the X Machine. I'm at Football Diehard. I'm the same thing on the Blue Ski device. So wherever you want to find me, I'm out there roaming around as Football Diehard.
Fair enough. Everyone, a great time today with a fellow fantasy football OG, someone, Hall of Famer, Fantasy Sports Writers Association Hall of Famer, Mr. Bob Harris. Until next time, when we get someone almost as interesting as Bob, this is Big John for the Big Questions right here on grumblingsmedia.com. Peace, everyone.
Thanks, John.